This is Joseph Rudy, The Jung White Friendship, The Untold Story, September 11, 2009.
So thanks for your patience, and thank you, all of you, for making the big leap to be here at this new venue. I just have to say that in addition to all of Joe's incredible accomplishments, he's just been a pleasure to work with. He's really... when you meet Joe and you speak to him on the phone, he just, his heart really is present, and you just feel that. He's a wonderful person, and we're just delighted to have him here with us, and we hope we have you back many, many more times. This is an incredibly vital topic. As a scholar of religion, I think it's probably one of the most crucial topics that we have to address in the Jungian world, this relationship between analytical psychology and Christianity. Edward Edinger said that Jung's work really can be looked at as the new dispensation, the next evolution, in a sense, of world cultural shift in its attitude toward the religious psyche, the objective psyche. And I think Joe really has his finger on that pulse, and I think we're going to be in for a treat to be walked through some of those questions and issues, and it should be a lot of fun. Joe, of course, as many of you know, was a priest for 14 years in his early life, and for the last 30 years has... been working as a psychologist and an analyst here in Seattle. So please welcome Joe.
What an introduction. Thank you very much. I wanted to start with a poem. It's from Mary Oliver. Mysteries, yes. Truly, we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of the lambs, how rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity, while we ourselves dream of rising, how two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken, how people come from delight or from scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. And I think the two people whom we'll be talking about tonight are two men who would understand that. That no one does know all the answers, and that those who think they do are not people that we want to keep company with. I want to talk about a friendship between Jung, Carl Jung, and Victor White. And you may know that friendships with men were not one of Jung's strong suits, but he did have a very intense and personal relationship with Victor White. When you read the newly published letters that came out a couple of years ago, you get a sense that these two men loved and trusted each other to the point where they were able to argue with each other, to disagree with each other, and thereby to help one another advance the thinking of each of them. But before I go into the letters themselves, I want to give you a little bit of background on each of these individuals. Let me start with Jung. He was the older. In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he wrote, my father did not dare to think because he was consumed by inward doubts. He took refuge from himself and therefore insisted on blind faith. At the time, too, there arose in me profound doubts about everything my father said. When I heard him preaching about grace, I always thought of my own experience. What he said sounded stale and hollow, like a tale told by someone who knows it only by hearsay and cannot quite believe it himself. I wanted to help him, but I did not know how. And whenever Jung tried to discuss with his father the miracle of grace, his father would just call on him, just believe. Just believe. Let it go. And he'd turn away. And Jung knew from his own experience that there was much more to the experiences of God and grace, much more of the experience than his father knew, than the arid faith of his father showed. He had had the experience of the dark side of the divine when he was very young, between 3 and 4 years old, when he had the famous phallus dream, in which he saw a large stone-lined underground chamber standing on a royal throne, something which he thought at first was a tree trunk, 12 to 15 feet high and 1.5 to 2 feet thick. It was huge and made of skin and naked flesh, and on the top a rounded head with no face and no hair. And on the very top was a single eye gazing motionless upward and surrounded by an aura of brightness. I was paralyzed with terror. At that moment I heard from outside and above me my mother's voice. She called out, "Yes, just look at him. That is the man-eater." That intensified my terror still more, and I awoke sweating and scared to death. The dream revealed to Jung a subterranean god not to be named. And the Lord Jesus was never the same for Jung after that. He never became quite real for me, never quite acceptable, never quite lovable. For again and again I would think of his underground counterpart, a frightful revelation which had been accorded to me without my seeking it. There was another significant incident that occurred close to the same time. He'd heard with his father, with irritation and fear in his voice, speaking with a colleague about the Jesuits. And then he saw a man walking down the street with a wide-brimmed hat and a black dress. And he was sure it was a Jesuit. And so he ran into the house and up to the attic, and he hid himself there for 3 or 4 hours before he could come down and face the world again. He thought it was a Jesuit. When he came down, the fear remained. Then several years later, when Jung was 6 years old on a trip to town, his mother pointed out a Catholic church to him. A nervous and curious Jung peered through the open door to catch a glimpse of the interior. He saw a richly decorated altar and then stumbled on a step and cut his chin badly on a piece of iron. My state of mind was curious. On the one hand, I was ashamed because my screams were attracting the attention of churchgoers. And on the other hand, I felt I had done something forbidden. Jesuits, the secret of the man-eater. So that is the Catholic Church, which has to do with Jesuits. It is their fault that I stumbled and screamed. For years afterward, I was unable to set foot inside a Catholic church without a secret fear of blood and falling and Jesuits. There was an aura or atmosphere that hung about it, but at the same time, it always fascinated me. The proximity of a Catholic priest made me even more uneasy, if that were possible. Not until I was in my 30s was I able to confront Mother Church without this sense of oppression. He went into St. Stephen's in Vienna. He was able to overcome that phobia. He was always on the outlook for something mysterious. So in a sense, in the Christian sense, he was religious, but always with the reservation. But it is not so certain as all that. And what about that thing under the ground? He had another experience when he was about 12 years old. He was walking home from school, from the gymnasium. It was a beautiful day, and he thought of the beautiful world and the beautiful Basel Cathedral. And he thought, and God made all this and sits above it, far away in the blue sky on a golden throne. And here comes a great hole in my thoughts and a choking sensation. Don't go on thinking now. Something terrible is coming, something I don't want to think. All I need to do now is not go on thinking. And he held the thought off for 3 days until he realized that Adam and Eve were indeed induced by God to sin, and that God had arranged everything so that the first parents would fall. They would have to sin. Eventually, Jung became convinced that he needed to be courageous and let the thought continue. God sits on his golden throne, high above the world, and from under the throne, an enormous turd falls upon the sparkling new roof, shatters it, and breaks the wall of the cathedral asunder. Jung felt great relief and bliss, and realized that he had experienced surrendering to the will of God. Afterwards, he thought that his father did not know that in his trial of human courage, God refuses to abide by traditions, no matter how sacred. If one fulfills the will of God, one can be sure of going the right way. Why did God defile his own cathedral? For me, that was a terrible thought. But then came the dim understanding that God could do something terrible. I had experienced a dark and terrible secret. It overshadowed my whole life, and I became deeply pensive. What we have here are the roots of Answer to Job. But we also have here the roots of the conflict, one of the basic conflicts between Victor White and Carl Jung. That is the question of evil. The last straw for Jung was his First Communion. Probably many of you have experienced First Communion, perhaps in an age when you really didn't realize what was going on. But Jung did. And he said nothing had happened. Among the others, I noticed nothing of that vast despair, the overpowering elation, an outpouring of grace which for me constituted the essence of God. Slowly I came to understand that this communion had been a fatal experience for me. It had proved hollow. More than that, it had proved to be a total loss. Well, that is not religion at all. It is an absence of God. The church is a place I should not go to. It is not life which is there, but death. These realizations removed Jung from his sense of union with the church and with the human world. He saw it as the greatest defeat of my life. The religious outlook which I had imagined constituted my sole meaningful relationship with the universe had disintegrated. I could no longer participate in the general faith. For God's sake, now, I found myself cut off from the church and from my father's and everybody else's faith. Insofar as they all represented the Christian religion, I was an outsider. So Jung in this way started his lifelong search to find some understanding of the mysteries of God, of evil, philosophy. What one notes here is his desire to help his father to an experiential understanding of God's grace. And the feelings that he had of helplessness, that he could not help his father to find grace and peace. Perhaps Jung spent his whole life trying to convert his beloved father to a new understanding of God and God's grace. Answer to Job was his last direct attempt, and Victor White may have been the last father whom he tried to convert. I want to say something about Victor White. Gordon Henry White, later as a Dominican friar, Victor White, was born in South Croydon, England in October of 1902. His father, John Henry White, was a high church Anglican vicar, as was his grandfather. Later, his younger brother, John Francis Christopher, also became an Anglican minister. It's not surprising that White, from an early age, felt that a clerical future was to be his path. And you see right away, you know that Jung had 8 uncles who were ministers. His father, his grandfather, his wife's family. So he was exposed to that. And we have White with a similar background where he was. White made some significant decisions early in adulthood. He reflected in a letter to John Layard, his first analyst in 1940, that his relationship with his father prevented him from becoming an Anglican priest. The details of the relationship are not available, but one can speculate that a major psychological change would have to occur within the psyche of a young man and the oldest of three sons for him to move beyond his father, an Anglican vicar, and first of all become a Catholic, and then become a Dominican, and then become a Catholic priest. As he later recalled, looking back on his conversion and subsequent life, the trouble with so many of us converts and adolescents is that something awfully difficult for you cradle Catholics to understand. The trouble is that one fine day we find that we did unconsciously pose when we became Roman Catholics. It was more a matter of culture, of our picture of the world, than of religion. We revolted from the whole Protestant materialist world and values in which we were brought up. For that, we substituted a beautiful, romantic, ages of faith, medieval world. The church was central in that pretty picture, and after playing with high Anglicanism, of course, we became Catholics. When White converted to Catholicism at 19 and was accepted for training to become a priest in the Diocese of Plymouth, studying at the English College in Spain, he left this college in 1923 to join the Dominicans. After completing his studies in philosophy and theology, he was ordained a priest on June 2, 1928. Then he was sent to Louvain, Belgium, a Jesuit college, by the way, where he studied and completed his licentiate in sacred theology in 1930. You had to have that particular document in order to teach theology. You still do. He was then appointed professor of dogmatic theology, and he taught moral theology and church history in the Dominican House of Studies at Blackfriars, Oxford University. Now, I need to say something about the philosophy that was prevalent at the time, and it may still be prevalent. And that's the theology, the theological and philosophical system of St. Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas was born about 1225, and he died in 1274. Let me just give you a look at Victor White. And then we'll go back. White wrote in 1932 that he feared that the tragedy that the Thomism of his day had failed sadly to keep pace with or even in touch with the progress of secular knowledge. White argued that it was Thomas Aquinas who had shown that all truth, whether it be found in science or philosophy or revelation, had the same source, God, from whom all truth came. Within such a framework, White, like Aquinas before him, was open to truth wherever it presented itself. Indeed, White saw it as his own task to build on Aquinas' achievement, suggesting that it is the aim of a modern Thomist to integrate all modern discoveries and scientific achievements, all that is truly valuable and permanent in post-medieval thought, into the Thomistic synthesis for the good of man and the glory of God. In short, to do for our own age what St. Thomas did for his, building on the foundation he laid. So what he wanted to do was take Thomism, which was the predominant philosophy and theology in the Catholic Church, and which the conservatives in the church at the time were stressing. What they would stress would be the transcendence, that God was way up there, just as an example. And White wanted to bring back the thought of the immanence, that the divine was not separate from humankind, but was within humankind and maybe even in creation. And he saw in Jung's writing some possibilities to be able to do that. Now, White was happy teaching theology and living in a community life for maybe 6 or 7 years, but towards the end of the 30s, when so much else was going on in the world, some things began to gnaw at him. The conservative politics of the Catholic Church and the common inevitable strains of community living were exacerbated in wartime and led in 1940 to into a general crisis about his identity as a theologian. Later he wrote, let's see if I can get... There's a picture of Victor. He said, I am by profession a theologian. Suddenly, or perhaps not so suddenly, theology ceased to have any meaning for me at all. I could not get my mind into it or anything to do with it, except with horror, boredom, and loathing. Those of you who have studied theology may be able to relate to that. Other theologians and pastors did not seem to be able to help me out of my difficulties. And so I was forced to turn to the psychologists. I had read a certain amount of Freud and Jung, and I did have a hunch that the method and approach of Jung might have something that spoke to my condition. White was going through a severe clinical depression and a serious midlife crisis. He considered leaving the Dominicans, as well as the Catholic Church, to return to the Anglican Church, to become a priest like his father and younger brother. It's always a temptation, isn't it? When we're in something that we thought we really wanted to do, and it starts to become dull and dry and sour, we want to go back home. And that's what he wanted to do. He eventually sought help and began working with a Jungian analyst, John Layard, to whom he initially wrote, I am a Catholic priest who has become badly stuck. It is in the writings of Dr. Jung that has given me some inkling of what I'm up against. Jung's approach was both intriguing and disturbing to White. His understanding of religious symbolism was deepened by his reading of Jung and his continued analysis with Layard, and he came to see how Jung's archetypal approach and his experiential, existential, and phenomenological approaches could play a part in reinterpreting Thomistic theology. But Jung's approach disturbed him. Why does Jung disturb me so? Because it is impossible to read him without drawing the conclusion that if Jesus had not existed, it would have been necessary to invent him. And if it were necessary to invent him, it seems unnecessary that he should have existed. Now, if you read, you can read that in Jung. He talks about the Buddha being the symbol of the self. He talks about Jesus Christ as being the symbol of the self. You know, that it's there. White was picking it up. Later he wrote to John Layard, his analyst, is there not considerable likelihood that Jungians, by going beyond their empirical data and making metaphysical affirmations which are not necessarily demanded by those data, may lay the foundation for a religion or a substitute religion which, so far from complementing Christianity, may contradict it radically. Kyle mentioned Edward Edinger thinking that Jungian psychology was the new dispensation. That's what White was fearing at this time. Before he'd even met Jung, just reading him, he sensed this is really some disturbing material. And you know how it is when you read disturbing material. You can't put it away. And that's what happened. By early November of 1940, White felt desperate at the edge of an abyss. I think I have this slide here. Oh, here we go. Okay. I feel I am on the brink of the underground, the Urgrund, where gods and demons proceed, the imminence of a descent into hell. I seem to have gone back in time to a devil-infested universe. A turning point came a few days later with three waking visions of a dazzling white sun, a windmill, and a revolving disc like the governor of a machine. Layard saw in this mandala symbolism, he saw it as one of fundamental change and suggested that White was ready to go back to teaching, a suggestion he fell in with. Indeed, I feel like a changed person at the dawn of a new life. Now I must thank God. The new life which White had found centered on his attempts to put his reflections on Jung and Thomistic theology into some kind of systematic form. Victor's personal healing experience with Jungian psychology was a major part of his motivation to pursue the interweaving of Jung's psychology with Catholic theology. When he returned to teaching, he felt like the cured leper who was told not to tell anyone what had happened to him. He needed to hide Jung under a bushel. As it turned out, he was unable to do so. Now let's go into the history of their relationship. This is Jung at his desk in 1945. You saw a picture of White that might have been around the same time period. The first letter from Victor White to Carl Jung, August 3rd, 1945. Dear Professor Jung, although I have never had the honor to meet you outside of my dreams, I'm taking the very great liberty of sending you some of my writings concerning your psychology, written from a Catholic point of view. I doubt, of course, that you will have time or inclination to read them, let alone comment on them. But should you ever do so, it would be a great help to me in any future work I am able to do if I could be shown any points on which I have positively misunderstood you. I might mention that there is a great and growing interest in this country among Catholics, as well as many others, in the theory and practice of analytical psychology, and that I am personally one of the very many who owe to you and your disciples in England an immense debt of gratitude. Yours very obediently, gratefully, Father Victor White, Order of Preachers. So very, very humble and very honoring of this older man. At the time of this letter, White was 42, 28 years younger than the world-famous 70-year-old Jung, and he's in awe of the wise old man and approaches him respectfully and very open to instruction. But while he is idealizing Jung, he has also sized up some of Jung's writing with a critical attitude appropriate to a recognized expert in theology and philosophy. And that's what you need to remember. White was recognized as an expert theologian. He knew his stuff. That's part of why Jung was attracted to him, because he dealt with Catholic theologians before, and they could never get out of their theology. As you'll see here, White could. White got into psychology. He didn't know where it was going to take him, but none of us does. On October 5th, 1945, Jung responded, "My dear Father White, in the meantime, I have finished reading the pamphlets you kindly have sent to me. My first reaction was, what a pity that you live in England and that I have you not at my elbow where I am blundering in the wide field of theological knowledge. Excuse the irreverential pun. You are to me a white raven, inasmuch as you are the only theologian I know of who has really understood something of what the problem of psychology in our present world means. You have seen its enormous implications. I cannot tell you how glad I am that I know a man, a theologian, who was conscientious enough to weigh my opinions on the basis of a careful study of my writings. This is really a rare occasion." After this enthusiastic reception of White's writings, Jung proceeds directly to a deeper explanation of his thoughts. Right away, they're talking about their differing views. The first response, the first interchange of letters. So Jung goes on, "Thus, when I say that God is a complex, I meant to say whatever he is at least a very tangible complex. You can say he is an illusion, but he is at least a psychological fact. I surely never intended to say he is nothing else but a complex." And then he goes on, "You have rendered justice to my empirical and practical standpoint throughout. I consider this a very meritorious act, since most of my philosophically or theologically minded readers overlook my empiricism completely." You can translate that. They would criticize Jung without reading his material. I mean, that was kind of the common practice. "I would never allow myself to make statements about the divine entity, since such would be a transgression beyond the limit of science. My personal view in this matter is that man's vital energy or libido is the divine noema, all right. And this was a conviction which it was my secret purpose to bring into the vicinity of my colleagues' understanding." Jung's statement about man's vital energy or libido is the divine noema. The noema is the Greek word for breath or air, wind. It's for the Holy Spirit. Okay, so what Jung is saying is that the life force, the libido within each human being is the Spirit. Okay. Now that's heresy. Okay. Just wanted to mention that. Then he goes on to say, you accuse me of repudiating the divine transcendence altogether. That is not quite correct. I merely omit it since I am unable to prove it. I don't preach. I try to understand and establish psychological facts. I can confirm and prove the inner relation of the God image with other parts of the psyche. But I cannot go further without committing the error of a metaphysical assertion which is far beyond my scope. I am not a theologian, and I have nothing to say about the nature of God. Here Jung's pointing out the distinction between the infinite mystery, which we human beings designate as God or the Godhead, and the images of God, and states that he can confirm the inner relation of the God image with the other parts of the psyche, but he cannot go beyond that. Jung also makes clear what his ultimate goal is and how difficult it will be, something that White has already acknowledged. This is Jung. It is of the highest importance that the educated and enlightened public should know religious truth as a thing living in the human soul and not as an abstruse and unreasonable relic of the past. Understanding begins with the individual mind, and this means psychology. It is a gigantic task indeed to create a new approach to an old truth. Jung seems to have been carried away by his enthusiasm in his lengthy response sent to his new interlocutor. And already in this initial exchange of views between the patriarchal psychologist and the brilliant young theologian, major topics of the future dialogue are brought up: metaphysics versus empiricism, immanence versus the transcendence of the divine. The willingness and the humility that each is showing in wanting to learn from the other is striking. Jung had been waiting to engage a theologian such as White for decades. Ever since decades before, he had attempted to debate theology with his father. And White, having been healed by the application of Jung's psychology and analysis, was hungry to learn more, both for the application of Jung's teachings to his pastoral work and for the task of revivifying Thomistic theology with the help of Jung's teachings. White expresses this in his next letter. For some time, I have found myself plowing a rather lonely furrow, painfully aware of the inadequacy of my experience on the psychological side and of my need for expert and understanding guidance, at least to the extent of some reassurance that I was not positively on the wrong lines from a psychological standpoint. The matter is one that has come to affect the whole of my life and work profoundly. Since reading your books and still sense from my own analysis, I found myself more and more compelled to expound the Summa of St. Thomas Aquinas. That was his opus, his great work. Excuse me. I don't know what that was. Perhaps it was a sign. That was the great work of St. Thomas Aquinas that has formed the backbone of Catholic teaching probably since the 13th century into the 21st century, which is quite interesting. Since reading your books and still more since my own analysis, I found myself more and more compelled to expound Aquinas' teachings in psychological terms and with constant reference to its vast psychological relevance and implications. In addition to this, I have accumulated an increasing amount of more personal work. I do not know whether to describe it as care of souls or psychotherapy. It is usually a concoction of both, varying greatly in proportion according to circumstances. Of course, I well understand that the approval of the general drift of my writings does not imply approval of my practical methods. But your assurance that I have in the main understood your work aright is a greater relief and comfort to me than I can possibly say. You get a sense here of the isolation that White was feeling. He really had gotten some sustenance from Jung. And he had some friends some other Dominicans with whom he could speak about this. But they were few, and he really needed this confirmation from Jung. And Jung gave it to him. Actually, White was practicing Jungian psychotherapy without any clinical training, except for his own analysis. In February 1946, Jung was also very open personally with Father White, telling him of the illness with which he had been struggling and the heavy workload which he was carrying. On April 1st, 1946, White wrote to Jung, "I've very much been wondering whether you would be able to spare me any time if I were able to come to Zurich or elsewhere for a few days during the summer vacation. I do very much hope that this suggestion will not appear over presumptuous, but it is impossible to say how much I should appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. But of course, I shall quite understand that if you feel you would not be able to spare the time, thanking you once again, dear Professor Jung, for all your kindness and most encouraging interest." Jung answered right away, "Dear Father White, I am pleased with your letter and I hasten to answer it at once. It is a nice idea of yours that you want to come out to Switzerland between July and September. I should like you to consider yourself as my guest during your stay here. I shall be in the country on the upper part of the Lake of Zurich, where I have a little country place. If you are a friend of the simple life, you will have all the comfort you need. To give you an idea, I do my own cooking, chop my wood, raise my own potatoes, but you'll have a decent bed and a roof over your head, and we shall have plenty of time to discuss anything under the sun. Yours sincerely, C.G. Jung." And White responded right away, "Dear Dr. Jung, thank you so very much. It sounds like my idea of heaven. My only misgiving is that I am the world's worst cook, and I see myself torn by the horrible dilemma of giving you indigestion or the humiliation of letting you cook my meal. I suppose the humiliation would be better for us both, but I'm going to try and get some lessons in cooking before August." Now, an invitation to Bollingen, as many of you know, was really a very personal gift from Jung. This is one view of it, and here is another picture of it. It was in the northern part of the Lake of Zurich, and it was very, very primitive. You know, wood fire, no electricity, no telephone. You cooked on wood, that kind of very simple life. And it was where Jung would go, as probably many of you know, when he needed to really think and ponder and write without disturbance. And to be invited into this inner sanctum, that was really a gift. And so they are together, and they're more open with each other. There are a couple of, there's a picture here that's interesting. In God's Shadow, that's the title of Ann Lammer's very good book, initial book on the relationship between White and Jung. And it's interesting to look at this picture because you may know that Carl Jung was a big man. I mean, he was really husky, and he was probably 6'2", 6'3", which was big at that time. And Victor White was a pretty little guy. And so what they did was they put White up on a step so that they'd be on the same level. And you notice the In God's Shadow, that was White's description of the picture, that he felt himself to be in God's shadow. So the ironic kind of humor as well as the respect is very much there. Later, after this visit in 1946, White shared with Jung an important dream. "A few nights ago, I dreamed that I was in a largish sailing boat sailing, for some reason I have not yet discovered, from Norway to England. I was roaming carefree all over the boat. You were the captain at the wheel. After a while, I noticed we were scudding along in a southerly direction at considerable speed and amid perilous rocks and shoals, but we always missed them. I knew there was no danger, not so much because you were at the wheel, but because the wind was taking care of us and would never wreck the pair of us. Presently, I found that we were speeding along very close to the shore on our left, but still we always missed it and its many promontories. After a while, we reached a small Danish coastal town. The boat, which you took calmly at the wheel, smoking your pipe, imperceptibly mounted the shore and sailed down the street, dexterously missing all the buildings and the traffic. She was amphibious. So they're sailing with the Neumann. And then Jung responded, "Dear Father White, your dream is very much to the point. I had all sorts of feelings and hunches about you and the risks you are running. We are indeed on an adventurous and dangerous journey, but the guiding principle of the wind is the Neuma. Norway is the northern country, that is the intuitive sector of the mandala." They're on a dangerous journey together, but Jung has a better idea of how dangerous it is. White is still very much in the first glow of the closeness to the wise old man. And soon he's offered an opportunity to be a further priestly service to Jung. Several days after he had written the above letter, Jung suffered a heart infarct and was very ill. When it seemed Jung was recovering, White wrote to him, "Dear Dr. Jung, I am extremely thankful to hear from Miss Schmidt that you are now able to read. I venture therefore to send you a few lines, but refrain from saying all that I should like to do. I need hardly tell you that you are very much in my thoughts and prayers at present, and as I know, in those of very many other people in England too. I am enclosing, as you asked, the fulminations about alchemy, although I hardly imagine you will want such dismal reading at present." You probably know that Jung was fascinated by alchemy, and he worked on it for decades and came out with some really interesting volumes on that. "I should like to know more about what the alchemy was that was practiced in our Dominican order at the time. I have a horrid idea it was mostly a way of making cheap money and still cheaper schnapps. I will not trouble you with more now. I am very well and in good spirits and hope that the Neume will continue to blow and keep us both off the rocks. Anyway, he knows best, and it's best to leave it to him. Ever yours sincerely, Victor White, O.P." And then, shortly thereafter, Carl Jung responded, "Dear Father White, thank you for your dear letter. It is a great consolation to know that one is included in the prayers of fellow beings. The aspect of death is a mighty lonely thing. When you are stripped of everything in the presence of God, one's haleness is tested mercilessly. An accumulation of drugs, however necessary, had made a complete rag of myself. I had to climb out of that mess and am now hale again. Yesterday I had a marvelous dream. One bluish, diamond-like star, high in heaven, reflected in a round, quiet pool. Heaven above, heaven below, the image of God in the darkness of the earth. This is myself. The dream meant a great consolation. I am no more than a black and endless sea of misery and suffering, but a certain amount thereof contained in a divine vessel. I am very weak, the situation dubious. Death does not seem imminent, although an embolism can occur at any time again. I confess to be afraid of a long, drawn-out suffering. It seems to me as if I were ready to die, although, as it looks to me, some powerful thoughts are still flickering like lightnings in a summer night. Yet they are not mine. They belong to God, as everything else which bears mentioning. Please write to me again. You have a purity of purpose which is beneficial. Thank you for the records. They're quite interesting. I don't know whether I can answer your next letter again, but let us hope. Gratefully yours, C.G. Jung." Victor is very grateful for Jung's letter. He writes quickly, "These can only be a very few brief lines to thank you enormously for the letter you wrote me from your bed. It moved me very much, and I am exceedingly grateful." Early in 1947, at the end of a longer letter, White writes, If you should ever care to write again, I should very much like it if you were to drop White and just call me Victor, even though I believe it is customary in Switzerland to be much more formal about titles and surnames than it is nowadays in England. In his next letter, Jung responds, "My dear Victor, as you see, I avail myself of your kind permission to call you by your first name. I hope you will reciprocate by calling me CG, which is the current designation of my unworthy paucity." So they're getting closer. They're becoming friends on a first name basis. Much later, after a sabbatical year in the United States, as White prepares to return to Dominican life in England, he writes of his concerns to his close friend. "My dear CG, I confess I am not relishing the idea either of leaving the USA or of returning to England and getting back again into harness and the old routine and responsibilities." What he had received was, in essence, a sabbatical paid for by a rich devotee of Jung and of the Dominicans in New York. So it was really quite a gift, and he really appreciated it. "I really do like it over here immensely, and by and large I seem to get on well with the people. I always feel I know where I am with them, and even their neuroses seem comparatively straightforward and uncomplicated. All this is perhaps largely a projection of the freedom of my own situation over here, but it does not alter the fact that I shall be very, very sorry to leave. Added to this has been a curious reoccurrence of dreams in which I find myself back in England, usually before I am due there, in a state of acute claustrophobic anxiety, though the dreams never seem to show anything to be anxious about. I have been able to make very little sense at all of these dreams." It's interesting, since we know the history, to look back on these dreams. But neither Jung nor White knew the meaning of it at the time. But it's clear that White is struggling here, and these struggles will continue. And Jung is concerned about his friend. Early in 1948, he writes, "Dear Victor, the Spirit prompts me to write to you. It is quite a while since I have heard of you, and very much longer since I have heard you really. I may be all wrong, but I confess to have a feeling as if when you were in America, a door had been shut, softly but tightly. I don't want to disturb you, but I feel as if I ought to tell you about my fantasy, so that you know my side of the picture at least. I know there are some things somewhere too damned difficult to be even mentioned, but they should not cut you off entirely. It is not bad for you to get a breath from the great wind of the world occasionally, and from all the dark things that go bump in the night. That is why I take the liberty to knock at your door. I suppose you are very busy. Don't feel pressed for an answer, please. I'm looking for my own peace, and that is a reason why I tell you about my qualms. Light that wants to shine needs darkness. Cordially yours, CG." It's hard to know exactly what Jung was picking up, and the letter of response from White has been lost. But there was a response, and then Jung wrote, "Dear Victor, thank you very much for your nice human letter. Now at least I know where you are. I was afraid America had spirited you away altogether." And then he goes on, "The combination of priest and medicine man is not so impossible as you seem to think. They are based on a common archetype, which will assert its right, provided your inner development will continue as hitherto. One's anxiety always points to our task." I'd like to underline that. "One's anxiety always points to our task. If you escape it, you have lost a piece of yourself, and at that a most problematic piece, with which the creator of things was going to experiment in his unforeseeable ways. They are indeed apt to arouse anxiety, particularly so as long as you can't see below the surface. The independent mind is you, is subject and object of the divine experiment." There's a palpable sense here on Jung's part of the unease and the uncertainty that he feels about his friend's psychic state. He senses that there are some important unconscious things that remain hidden to White, and that will involve profound changes. In September of 1953, White wrote Jung a thank you note. "My dear C.G., it is over a week since I left Bollingen, but I have not yet hitherto had much opportunity to thank you and Mrs. Jung for your very kind reception of me. It was very refreshing to be at Bollingen again, and I was particularly grateful to you for listening patiently and helpfully to my own mild case." By November, the mild case had become more serious, and White wrote, "My dear C.G., he's in crisis here. "My dear C.G., the dilemma reduced to his simplest terms seems complete and insoluble. If Christ is no longer an adequate and valid symbol of the self, and in fact very inadequate, one-sided, unintegrated, and harmful, then must one not one choose at whatever cost? Faith in him, it seems to me, must be unconditional. Once one criticizes Christ, one has lost faith in him, and one cannot in honesty preach him anymore. And one has lost any sense of oneness that one ever had with one's community, with the church, with the cause that animates them. I have come to realize how many of my friends and analysands I have positively helped to get out of the church. Yet I am paid. I owe my bread and butter to the alms and gifts of good Christians who support me in the belief that I am a good Christian priest, laboring to bring all I can into the one ark of salvation. Their God simply isn't my God anymore. My very clerical clothes have become a lie. I feel acutely that the position has become morally impossible and dishonest, and increasingly I find it psychologically and even physically impossible too. So I tell myself from time to time that whatever the cost, I must get out. I don't relish the idea of starting life again at 51 in a world for which I am totally unequipped. But what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? And the pearl of great price requires that a man give all that he has. So I almost decide I must pack up and go, and for a while I feel in peace and tranquility. I did so 2 days ago, but, and something of the sort has happened to me on similar occasions before, I promptly had a nightmarish dream. Well, my dear C.G., I won't bother you anymore with this. Anyway, it's all just as simple and, so far as I can see, as insoluble as that. I don't expect an answer, though I cannot pretend I should not like one. I don't think there is an answer. But I am just indescribably lonely, and it's some relief to me to tell you. I must confess there are times when I wish to heaven I had never heard of your psychology and some of your disciples, and that I tremble to think what would have happened if I hadn't." So he's in crisis, and he doesn't really know what to do, and he wants an answer. Later in the month, his good friend C.G. responds to the cry from the anguished soul of his friend whom he knows and loves. "Dear Victor, forget for once dogmatics and listen to what psychology has to say concerning your problem. Christ as a symbol is far from being invalid, although he is one side of the self and the devil the other. But becoming man, he, Christ, becomes at the same time a definite being, which is this and not that. Thus, the very first thing Christ must do is to sever himself from his shadow and call him devil. When a patient in our days is about to emerge from an unconscious condition, he is instantly confronted with his shadow, and he has to decide for the good, otherwise he goes down the drain. He imitates Christ and follows his example. The first step on the way to individuation consists in the discrimination between himself and his shadow. Now tell me how many people you know who can say with any verisimilitude that they have finished their dealing with the devil and consequently can chuck the Christian symbol overboard. Since the Christian church is a community of all who have surrendered to the principle of the imitation of Christ, this institution, that is such a mental attitude, is to be maintained until it is clearly understood what the assimilation of the shadow means. Those that foresee must, as it were, stay behind their vision in order to help and to teach, particularly so if they belong to the church as her appointed servants. You should not mind if some of your analysands are helped out of the church. It is their destiny and adventure. Others will stay in it anyhow. It does not matter whether the ecclesiastical powers in being approve of your vision or not. Jung could say that. He didn't really understand the circumstances that White, as a religious priest, was living in. And I should mention, too, that in 1953, most of you are not old enough to remember 1953, but I can, Pius XII was the Pope, and everything was rock solid and secure. Nothing had changed, as John Dorley puts it, since the 13th century, and that all was shattered with Vatican II, but that was 10, 15 years later. So these are the circumstances. And the other thing is, when a priest left in those times, he was truly excommunicated. He was shamed. He was persona non grata. He was simply a member of the unwashed forever. So that was the fate that White was considering. Now, he could have gone and become an Anglican priest. I mean, in England, that probably would have been, you know, something that were possible. I'm just trying to give you a sense of what the situation was and how profound it was for this man. Whatever your ultimate decision will be, you ought to realize it before staying in the church, that staying in the church makes sense, as it is important to make people understand what the symbol of Christ means, as such understanding is indispensable to any further development. My best wishes, yours cordially, C.G. Victor's response to Jung's answer is humble and grateful. My dear C.G., I'm very penitent for having prompted so long and tiring a letter from you. I feel it was very inconsiderate of me thus to add to your labors, but I am immensely grateful to you. There is no doubt that it will be a great help, but I must sink into it all the more than has yet been possible. Thank you a million, my dear C.G., for this token of your interest and friendship. Ever cordially, Victor. With Jung's understanding and support, White decided to remain a Dominican and a priest, and he received his Master's of Sacred Theology degree in May of 1954. He expected to be appointed regent of Blackfriars College, a position for which he had been groomed for some years. However, subsequent to the death of the Dominican Father General, changes in the leadership positions in the Dominican order were made, and the superiors of his order appointed someone else regent. Father White was then asked to consider going to the Dominican study house in Oakland, California. From Oxford, England, to Oakland, California. In a letter to Jung dated September 25th, 1954, White writes, "The problem has been changed considerably, at least from the outside. I think the last you heard was when I got to taking that oath and the mastership in theology. It was the oath against modernism that still is administered to all pastors and bishops, anyone in authority in the Catholic Church. With considerable help from your letter, urgings from my superiors and colleagues, and a big kick from the I Ching, all was set for me not only to continue teaching here this year, but also to become regent of studies. Then in early August, I suddenly got a letter from my boss, the provincial, in which I learned that someone else, a complete incompetent, was to be appointed regent, and asking if I would like to go to California. After many delays, this has at last been fixed up. I'm still very much in the dark, both about why I have been moved and what I am supposed to do when I get there. But I have also been having quite a lot of conflicts about what I should do under these circumstances. However, I finally decided to go and to see what awaits me there. Anyhow, for some reason or another, I am no longer indispensable at Oxford. Indeed, I seem to be very definitely not wanted. I am left still guessing the reasons. There could be several, but in some ways, of course, it is a huge relief. Thus, in secret, Victor Wife's life as a professional and renowned theologian was destroyed. He had been trained to and was expected to accept the change without protest, to obey like a good Dominican. His writing to Jung of a huge relief was part of this attempt. But Father White had other feelings as well. Perhaps partially or even totally unconscious feelings. These feelings seem to have festered unnoticed over the months that followed his exile to California, until they broke through in his review of Jung's Answer to Job, which was published in the March 1955 issue of Blackfriars, which was a Dominican journal. In this review, White included personal attacks on Jung, accusing him of bad faith, childish ignorance, independence, and paranoia. This review hurt Jung deeply, and these two close friends drifted apart. There certainly was a strong element of displacement of White's anger rage related to his frustrations with religious life, in particular with the most recent humiliation of removal and exile, which seemed to have contributed to this outburst. White seems to have had limited consciousness of what he was writing and the possible effect on his friend, C.G. After White's review had been published, he had become somewhat aware of what he had done. "I'm very afraid, indeed, that you will think my review unforgivable. There are some passages I would now wish to have kept to myself." And then, as happens in any friendship when there's a difficulty, you kind of apologize, and then you defend yourself. "I wonder what induced you to publish it. I just do not understand what is to be gained by publication of such an outburst, however cathartic for yourself and profoundly moving for your intimate friends. I am sorry, but I just see no sense in guying publicly the Christian beliefs, symbols, myths, virtues, which you tell us elsewhere were never so essential as now." So there's a mix of regret and sorrow, but also a stronger element of anger, which is probably a reaction to White's exposed position and accompanying feelings of anxiety and helplessness as a Catholic priest and a Jungian analyst preaching to Catholic believers who would not get Answer to Job. In Jung's long letter of April 2, 1955, he defends his book at length and tells White directly that his criticism was out of line, while at the same time expressing his understanding of White's untenable position. "Your criticism of my motive concerning Job is certainly unjust, and you know it. It is an expression of the mental torment you had to undergo and in Europe. Nobody has more sympathy with your predicament than I have, since more than 50 years of uphill work outside and of the current curtain rent have taught me something. Having chosen the life of the monk, you have separated yourself from the world and exposed yourself to the eternal fires of the other. Somewhere you will have to pay the toll either to man or to God, and in the end you will discover that both overcharge you. It would be a great mistake to think you can slip through such an ordeal without the most violent emotion. You yourself are profoundly emotional about it, and you could not make anyone believe that you are not in a hell of suffering. There is no comfort and no consolation anywhere except in the submission to and acceptance of the self, or you may call it the God, that suffers in his own creation." And then he quotes Isaiah, "I have tried you and chosen you in the furnace of affliction. For my sake, for my own sake, I will do it. So Jung is describing to White, using scripture, the transforming suffering which White is experiencing and will experience to the end of his life. And what's remarkable is that Jung understands to some extent what White is going through, even though he knows that what he's written is not justified. White is projecting his unconscious defensive anger onto Jung, and Jung understands the anger that White is feeling. But these very close friends seem to be separating, yet they continue to communicate. And Jung wrote White the following letter prior to the next meeting. This is in May of 1955. The review was written in March, and the responses were in the intervening time. Dear Victor, the serious illness of my wife has consumed all my spare time. Emma Jung had cancer. It turned out to be terminal. She was in the process of dying. She has undergone an operation so far successfully, but it has left her in a feeble state, needing careful nursing for several weeks to come. After some hesitation, Jung and White do meet briefly at the convalescent home in Mamern, where Emma Jung was convalescing after her cancer surgery. The meeting was a disaster. Afterwards, White wrote, "My dear CG, I am afraid it was disgracefully inconsiderate of me to trouble you with my very mundane problems regarding answer to Job, when you yourself have so many other cares within and without. I earnestly hope that Mrs. Jung is now well on the mend. Her illness alone must have given you great anxiety. And of course I realize you have many other cares on your mind. It was so heartless of me to bother you with such very different problems, and so ruthlessly. Evidently I must work them out on my own as best I can, and perhaps in our mutual solitude the reconciling symbol has a better chance to grow than from any amount of talk. For myself, it seems that our ways must, at least to some extent, part. I shall never forget, and please God, I shall never lose what I owe to your work and your friendship. It seems my role, at least for a year or two, is to be that of a very independent Catholic priest in California." Excuse me. 15 months later, in August of 1956, White wrote again to Jung. And let me show you. There's Jung in 1955, about the time that these events occurred. And there is Victor White with another one of his Dominican colleagues in California in 1956. In the intervening time, this is White sweeping, sailing near Sweden. Not quite to mention. In August of 1956, White wrote to Jung, "My year in California has been a rather wearing but profitable experience. I feel much more settled within myself now. Not that any problems are solved, but they don't seem to matter so much anymore. I feel more ready to plow a lonely furrow." On June 1, 1958, almost 2 years after his last letter, White wrote again to Jung. So there are no letters for several years. And he mentioned that he would be in Switzerland and would be happy to come to Küsnacht, where Jung had his home, for a meeting if Jung so desired. And then White wrote, "I've lately been rereading the generous and most stimulating letters you have written me in the past. They have been most helpful in finding myself. I am, in fact, pretty well and happy these days, and better able to contain the empirical church, though less than ever than able to be contained by it. I think often of you, dear CG, with great affection and gratitude, and I very much hope that all goes as well as possible with you in this vale of tears. Please do not trouble to reply to this unless my suggestion is possible that we meet and that's agreeable to you. Ever cordially, Victor." There was no answer. Both Jung and White had suffered profound losses in the last several years. Jung of Emma and all that she meant to him, as well as the continuing deterioration of his own health, and White of his profession as a professor of theology, and the loss of his close friendship with Jung, the only remains of which are the old letters from his friend in which he now finds sustenance. White had a serious motor scooter accident in April of 1959, which left him permanently impaired in sight and hearing. His mental recovery seemed complete, but in September of that year, he was hospitalized for abdominal pain, which later, after exploratory surgery, was diagnosed as incurable stomach cancer. The accident was the occasion of renewed communication between Jung and White, and some continued discussion of their perceived differences. White seemed surprised at Jung's statement in a letter to the Mother Prioress. There was a Mother Prioress, and White went there to say Mass. And she wrote to Jung and told him what had happened about White's accident. And so Jung had written to the Mother Prioress, "I am glad you give me some news about Father White's activity. Thus I know that he does not fully disapprove of my work." And then White replied, "I smiled somewhat cynically at your remark that I did not wholly disapprove of your work. How could I? It seems that I am in quite serious trouble, and with Rome itself, for apparently my approval of it, so much so that my future is quite uncertain." To which Jung's response was, "Concerning my doubts about your general attitude, I must mention in self-defense that you expressed yourself publicly in such a negative way about my work that I really did not know what your real attitude would be." And White did not understand. He wrote, "In your last letter you wrote to me, you expressed yourself in such a negative way, I really did not know what your real attitude would be. I have been and still am not a little distressed that you should think this." At some point, Jung seemed to have realized that some of the differences between himself and his dear friend were not going to be resolved. He had already expressed his understanding for the kind of pressure White was under from the church authorities and the risks he ran right from the beginning in working with Jung. He may also have considered the possible organic effect of a serious head injury which White had suffered in the Vespa accident. At any rate, Jung was loving and reassuring in his response. "My dear Victor, don't worry. I think of you in everlasting friendship. No one is required to do more than he can. Thus I ask for your forgiveness, as is incumbent on one who has given cause for scandal and vexation. My best wishes in every respect." Somewhere around this time, Jung sent a postcard to White. Jung's health was such that he couldn't travel. White's health was such that he couldn't travel. And so what Jung said on this postcard, "I can't present myself to you in person, but here I am in effigy." Okay. Jung wrote White a further letter on April 30th, 1960, and he closed it with the following paragraph. "In the meantime, I hope you don't worry about my letter. I want to assure you of my loyal friendship. I shall not forget all the useful things I have learned through our many talks and through your forbearance with me. I was often sorry to be a stone of scandal. It was my fate, however, and not my choice, and I had to fulfill this unbecoming role. Things had to be moved in the great crisis of our time. Many greetings and cordial wishes. Yours ever, C.G. White, who knew that his stomach cancer was terminal, wrote two subsequent letters, one continuing discussion with Jung, the last one simply closing their earthly discussion. This is on May 8th of 1960. "My dear C.G., I composed and dictated the enclosed incoherent letter before your wonderful and comforting letter dated April 30th arrived. I'm sending it to you all the same. Of course, I well understand that it is impractical for us to meet at present. Perhaps we will meet in another world or dimension where we know even as we are known. But I'm now finding it is one thing to write a book, especially that part on life and death, and that it is quite another to live it and to have to keep these opposites constantly in mind and together. If ever you should have time or inclination to send me any comments on anything in my new book, Soul and Psyche, of course I should be delighted and profited. I do not know if it is true that you have been a stone of scandal to me, as you say you have. But to the extent that you have been, I think I can honestly say that I am grateful for it. May I add that I pray with all my heart for your well-being, whatever that may be in the eyes of God. Ever cordially and affectionately, Victor White. Below his signature, White drew a straight line. He died in the late morning of May 22nd, 1960. His last words were, "God take me." While C.G. Jung and Victor White learned from each other and also vigorously disagreed with each other on several important subjects, they did develop a very close and personal friendship. In the end, it was their loving friendship which was predominant. In Jung's words, "I have had a huge correspondence, see innumerable people, but have only two real friends with whom I can speak about my own difficulties. The one is Eric Neumann, and he lives in Israel, and the other is Father Victor White in England." Thank you very much.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.